So I'm Richard. I'm going to talk about why certain dynamical things I think are cool. Can we find them? I hope so. And can we make things that are interesting? I think so. So what I'm going to be talking about for the most part is formation in near very massive objects, where you have a flow orbiting around and gradually sweeping up material, bringing it closer and closer and closer in, spiraling, spiraling, spiraling. Now, eventually, this object will go, this accretion flow will go away, but then it will be revitalized by additional flows of matter onto the supermassive black hole, accreting again and again and again and again, each time giving us a little burst of gravitational wave sources. Thank you, thank you. I will disentangle temporarily. Okay. So in the interest of time, I'm not going to talk about all the stuff that Carl talked about yesterday. I'm just going to skip that. Oh, I need a stick. In case people have questions.
And you can hit the...
Yeah, I get it. And Cole's right there.
Yes.
So I
can really...
far distance for me, but Cole, you can...
I can really smack him. So I'm sure Alessandro will talk more about that. Eccentric sources are fun and interesting, and as relativists, we want to make the most exciting sources that we can. Oop, wrong direction. Eccentric sources are fun. They have lots of modes. We search, unfortunately, with one mode at a time, basically one M, and this means that in general, particularly when the sources get complicated, they're hard to find. So this is one of Duncan's papers, a plot of the basically how effectively you'll find binary neutron stars of a given eccentricity as a function of eccentricity, and it basically starts to plummet right around the time when the eccentricity starts to get interesting. Now, if you do a burst search, you can do a lot better, so that's great, in terms of you can find highly eccentric things, except it's hard to find highly eccentric long, long things, and so there's a lot of work going on there. So I think that's cool, and it's wonderful that we're looking for these, particularly because if we find one, then there's a lot of power, as we discussed yesterday, at very low frequencies, so potentially we can measure very, very tiny eccentricities if we're fortunate enough to get one of these super-duper eccentric sources. But that's all I'm going to say about that. Okay, so if there's no further questions, we will go to part two, the non-skipped part, the contribution from active galactic nuclei disks. So the idea here, Owen, reference. Okay. So the idea here is that LIGO has laid out a map, telling us, okay, we know roughly the outlines of the continents. There's a bunch of stuff, you know, 30-ish solar masses, some stuff at low mass. A lot of things look like they're equal mass, but you'll notice that there are some places on the map that haven't been filled in. Now, in the early age of exploration, the traditional thing that one does when one doesn't know what, you know, is off the edge of the map, is one puts a dragon out there and says, I have no idea. So here's dragons at high mass and dragons at high mass ratio. And so what I'm going to do today, you might think of as a story about dragons. It's a story about trying to figure out how we can populate this region in an interesting way, and where either killing these dragons and getting rid of them, or you know maybe we'll be lucky and actually find one, will tell us something about the universe. Okay, so we've talked a lot about conventional formation channels. We haven't talked about primordial formation channels because no one has any idea what they are. I'm going to talk about something in between those two in terms of the level of ignorance, which is near supermassive black holes, which we see. They're great. We have great statistics for supermassive black holes. We see small black holes very close to supermassive black holes, our own galactic center. There's lots of X-ray sources. You can count up how many there are. You can be confident that there's gravitational segregation and see there's reasonable estimates of 10,000, 20,000 black hole sources mass segregated near our galactic center. And if there is an accretion flow, one can imagine that these black holes will be punching back and forth through the disk, gradually occasionally align with the disk, and then get dragged along in this very massive disk close to the supermassive black hole and get accreted onto it. Now, if that was all that was happening, this would not be a talk about ground-based interferometers, which is largely what I'm going to focus on. This would be a very interesting talk for Lisa. However, they don't always have to migrate in. Sometimes they can pause. And sometimes, and the migration rate turns out to depend on mass. More massive things migrate faster. And so, if, which is kind of backwards, my children are actually much faster than I am. But imagine that I, with my longest stride, am chasing my children down and sweeping them up in my arms. Then I'm getting more and more massive, and for some reason, somehow running faster. That's the sort of mental image that you should have in mind. And I agree that that doesn't make any sense in terms of an analogy, but it's the basic idea. So, the idea is near a galactic nucleus, there's a brief but very efficient phase of forming binary black holes, where you have them spiraling in through a disk. The more massive ones go faster, and they'll generally be moving inward. Now, it turns out that accretion torques in disks are complicated. Andrew was here a week or so ago and probably talked all about this in more detail. It's not necessarily true that you have to emit spiral density waves outward and go in uniformly. There are positions in the disk under certain circumstances in which you stop going in. It's called a migration trap. And so that means that you're sending your black holes in, that they've been captured in the disk, they're sailing on inward and then they stop. And ones inside move outward to the location of this trap location. So that is cool. That means instead of just having to rely on luck for the fast movers catching the slow movers, there's a place where these things are going to pile up. So you have, loosely speaking, two general prospects for getting binary black hole mergers in this disk. One is the fast movers catching the slow movers, moving through the disk, and the other is piling up in this migration trap. So, roughly speaking, what do you see in these sorts of scenarios? Well, let's suppose you put in a burst of black holes in your disk. This is going to be about 1,000. And you're going to gradually keep on piling them in. And I'll give you concrete numbers in a second. You'll get a burst of binary black hole mergers. This is a function of time. This is the black hole mass of the two black holes that are merging. So there's two dots for every merger. This will be particularly clear for the red dots. The red dots are in that special migration trap that we talked about, where you're constantly feeding things in. Black holes are assumed to merge if they're closer than a Hill radius from each other. So what you'll see, you see pairs of dots here, pair of dots here, pair of dots here, is very quickly in this migration trap, you make one really big black hole, which grows with time, by merging from black holes in this lower mass component. Additionally, you'll have black holes merging throughout the disk, doing their happy thing. Now, this is wonderful. This addresses two of our dragons. One, we get really big black holes, so that's fantastic. And two, the black holes that you're merging are preferentially very high mass ratio. In this case, they can go up to 2,000 solar masses. So you can get a very high mass ratio system, which as a relativist is fantastic. If you do lots and lots of these simulations and you time average them, this is actually a linear distribution represented in the log. So these dotted lines are a linear approximation to the solid lines, which are the results of simulations. Basically, this linear growth is an excellent approximation, averaged over time, averaged over many, many different situations and many different assumptions. So what will change from model to model is the maximum mass, which depends on how you feed it, how many black holes there are. But the idea that you basically have one black hole that gets big is pretty common and universal. So that's fantastic. So what does this do? And I'm going to be super brief. What this does is it builds up hierarchically intermediate mass black holes. Almost all of the mergers that you're going to see in the trap are going to be these hierarchical mergers. Principally first generation with a higher order generation, although you can build up a very small component of instead of having the IMBH merge with everything else, you can have a second generation merge with some higher order generation and produce a few mergers. But by and large, at least for the initial conditions that we're considering, there's a very small number of trap mergers because the intermediate mass black hole is sucking up only those things that pass through it. And the vast majority of mergers that are going on are mergers that occur in the bulk before you get to the migration trap. Now, so that's one observationally interesting signature. The other observationally interesting signature for this is the spin distribution. So this is not as interesting as I was hoping. I was hoping this would be a little bit more extreme. But time averaging, what you roughly find, the bulk distribution, I mean, you put something in, you make some assumptions for how black holes form. So this is basically a uniform distribution on each individual object, and then you end up, if you have two of them, you end up with this characteristic peak at zero chi effective, because they could either be up or down. As you merge over time, however, you're preferentially going to be merging with an object which, as some of you have worked on, was the result of a previous generation of mergers. And that means that one of those objects, the more massive object, thing in the trap, has a characteristic spin of about 0.7. Now this gets blurred out a bit because it's then going to merge successively with objects that are either in prograde or retrograde orbits. But you do tend to get two characteristic peaks associated with this natal spin of the first pair of merging black holes.
Wait, Richard, are you assuming that every time these merge, they're essentially merging coplanar with the agendas?
We're assuming, there's lots and lots of assumptions that I'm skipping. We're assuming efficient gas alignment for pretty much everything. So there's almost complete alignment of everything through almost all time. There's a couple things which aren't completely perfect alignment, but effectively you can assume it's all perfect alignment through the whole thing. Yes?
So along those lines, with alignment with the local motion of the gas, right?
Mm-hmm.
The gas is turbulent. So what is the local motion of the gas?
We're assuming the large-scale time-averaged order because the migration is still, I think, unless I've mistaken something, long compared to the turbulent time scale of the gas. So we're time averaging over all the complexities of the disk. And the disk is, this is a thick disk, this is complicated, we're not putting in any radiated feedback. This is very simple.
There's no actual simulation of the capture itself, right? There's only 2D, right?
So we have a Hill sphere, and everything within the Hill sphere gets captured. So yes, we're not doing the dynamics of the as the two objects approach and they're each clearing their own Hill spheres and then they get close. There's no gas dynamics. This is just objects in a disk.
So you're assuming everything is aligned.
We're not exactly assuming that, but effectively, yes.
So where does the negative effect come from?
We're assuming they're either aligned or anti-aligned. So they can be in prograde or retrograde. So they can form in prograde or retrograde orbits, and the spins can be either up or down.
Okay.
Effectively. So that's why you get two sides. So this is the prograde formation, and this is the retrograde.
So the spins are always aligned with each other. But not necessarily.
This.
And it can be also.
Yes. So there. Sorry. Let me back up. The black hole comes into the disk with some crazy spin. It comes into the disk with whatever spin it has. Okay. It gets circularized through the disk. Its spin aligns. Now it could also have come in the other way, and its spin will get aligned the other way. So that
confuses me because there's a time scale for alignment.
Yes.
And it'll be alignment if you wait long enough. There won't be counter alignment.
Oh, I might have said that wrong. So because I didn't code this part of the simulation, I believe it is. The first generation of black hole spins are the confusing ones. So let me make sure I remember this correctly. I think the first generation of black hole spins have a alignment torque. And then the binary is more aligned. So when they form binaries, they get aligned. The spins are aligned with the L of the binary, which is assumed aligned with the disk. So the individual black hole spins in the first generation, when they're coming in, are not assumed aligned. This is the thing I didn't want to talk about because it's messy and I didn't do it, so I'm not sure of every single detail. But I believe that all that we do is we have an alignment torque. So the thing I said about them misaligning the other way is incorrect. What happens is they form, the first generation has whatever alignment they get. There's some alignment torque, which is gradually torquing them back. And then after they form as binaries, then there's alignment of the L of the binary. Let me think if I remember exactly what happens with the merger. And then the merger remnant is assumed to be either aligned or anti-aligned. Because the J is parallel to the disk orbital angular momentum, so it's either aligned or anti-aligned, depending on whether the orbit is prograde or retrograde.
Shouldn't you still have a preference for positive spins, though, over time? Because, like, okay, so imagine I merge and produce something that's... Oh, hang on, let me think about this correctly. So I have something that is initially spin-aligned, but it merges counter-rotation, so essentially it's spin-anti-aligned. That remnant's going to have a remnant spin of, like, 0.4 or something like that. Because essentially I'm transporting in these large negative... It's essentially a negatively aligned system. So the spins will cancel out part of the angular momentum.
You're going to go into another... So there's another thing which I'm trying not to talk about. So there are different... efficiencies for forming binaries that are prograde or retrograde, depending on whether they're prograde or retrograde. It doesn't have a large effect, so we barely talk about it in the paper. But there's another factor in there that is included for the migration in spiral and hardening is different for the two types of binaries.
So I thought the picture you were saying, so you were describing that the initially formed black holes have whatever spin they have.
Yes.
That there may be accretion torque, which helps realign them a little bit,
but it largely has no effect.
You're agnostic about that.
Yeah.
The merger, you're assuming, actually aligns with the sense of motion in the disk.
Yes.
But I thought the later picture was that if you have two black holes with whatever spins, that they can capture prograde or retrograde.
Yes.
And could there be this or this? The possibilities.
No, you can have so the first generation black holes does whatever it does, and let's just look at the remnants of those.
Yeah.
So they're depending on whether they were caught in a prograde or retrograde orbit, they're either like this. So you have a population. The first generation is like this or like this, and then you draw random pairs from this population, and you get some of one quarter of this, one quarter of this, one quarter of this, one quarter of that. Did I finally communicate effectively what it is that I think we are doing?
So the orbit is what's giving you the alignment spin.
Yes.
Not necessarily the accretion. Accretion is possibly a component, but it's a minimal one compared to the actual...
alignment of the binary relative to the disk.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure I said all that correctly.
Okay.
Other questions? Okay. I will move on. All right. Now, this is a very, very... very uncertain model. To emphasize how uncertain, I wanted to walk through some order of magnitude calculations that you can find in the literature. There's some by Brian, there's some by Barry. These things are basically normalized to things that you do know, like the volume density of AGN-like things based on the X-ray binary background of the universe, which is relatively well studied, and things that you don't know, like how long your AGN accretion episodes are going to last, because there's some efficiency in duty cycle, and how many black holes are going to be advected from that larger population, segregate down into the disk and get aligned. And so you may know this, and you may have some idea about this, but as you move down, these get to have some factors that you're not quite certain about. The total number of black holes that you see in our galactic center, about 2×10^4, is a reasonable place to start. 10 million years for our AGN lifetime is, characteristic burst time is reasonable. This is a fraction of AGN that are merger sites, so maybe some AGN don't have this process occur, although why it occur in some disk and not in others is not immediately clear. And then we'll have some fraction of black holes that form in binaries because not all of them get convected in. And so you can get numbers of about 10^3, but depending on what you do with these factors, and this is a very simplified version of a longer Drake equation that Barry has, you can make this factor smaller or slightly larger, depending on what you assume. So this can very easily explain, and in fact over-explain, the sort of merger rates that you see by LIGO. And the majority of these would be bulk mergers, and some fraction of these of order a third or so.
Can you go back to that Drake equation? So the FAGN is the fraction of galactic nuclei that are currently AGN or that ever were at some point in their life an AGN?
So AGN. The fraction of galactic nuclei that for which this process can occur.
But it's a process. It might have occurred
in the past.
A billion years ago,
yes.
Or the 10 mega years of this operation.
Yes. And so this, Yeah, this is a number of galactic nuclei. So this is not the number of active galactic nuclei. So that's the feature that you're concerned about. Yes, this is. So if you take the number of AGN, well, you mean something
but
that's really bright.
I'm still confused about the rate. Why does the tau AGN matter for the overall rate? If you assume that, you know, let's assume every galaxy was an AGN, so FAGN is one in the simple case.
Yeah.
Right. The NBH is the number, is the total number of black holes, and NBH FD, mm-hmm. sorry, it's FD or FB, I guess you have FB down there. But.
Yeah, so there's two of them. So your concern is that if you time average this, why would this tau AGN show up at all?
Right.
Because what you really ought to do is think about, you're advecting all of the black holes onto the entire system, and if you time average over all the states of the two things, I think that basically gets absorbed into, let me think, I didn't phrase this the right way. I think the right way to think about this is that would occur in some ratio of the two, but that can't be right, because then there's a duty cycle.
So, Richard, energy and the first number, this is the number and density of galactic nuclei?
Yes.
Okay. So it's, and what is the
definition? I mean, I think it would make sense if FAGN is the fraction of galaxies that are currently AGNs, then you divide by the lifetime and it's appropriate. But if it's the number that ever were, it seems to me the lifetime is irrelevant.
But if it's the lifetime that are now, then... So the idea is that we're trying to account for, I think what you're saying makes sense, but let me go through this because I walked through this again this morning. So we have a certain number of black holes that are going on to the AGN. We have a certain number of black holes that, of those that make it into this process. And so the question is basically, what is the fraction of galactic, what is the density per unit time of times this site occurs. And there will be some sort of efficiency process. And your point is that it should not have the overall efficiency because
right.
we're
considering. I mean, what you care about is the total number of black holes that get formed by this process.
Mm-hmm.
And it's integrated over, you know, the age of the universe, basically, and spread with some distribution, but if mm-hmm. you sort of consider, you know, redshift 0 to 1, it seems to me that the tau AGN can't possibly be relevant. It doesn't matter whether all 10 to the 4 black holes are made in 1 year or a billion years or a mega year.
But if they get... I think the idea is that this gets replenished. Let me remember exactly how this works. That this is not... That this accounts for the fact that this is not, if you would divide by this number if this number didn't change, but if this is getting repopulated every time you have a cycle, then you would have to account for how many cycles you have, how many bursts of accretion efficiency. So I think the reason why you have a tau AGN here is because this factor here is the number of black holes in the neighborhood of the disk that occur for one accretion episode.
Yes, it's per
tau AGN. So the idea is that you have an AGN episode, you clear out 10%, not all of them. There's some fraction of things that merge, it's of order a few. And this gets partially depleted, and then it gets repopulated again.
Oh, but still, I don't think that's how it can be tau AGN. It should just be a number, right? If you have 10 episodes that create them, then it's just a factor of 10. The lifetime that should enter is the evolution time of the universe.
Yes, but then we would have to correct this by. So I can go through this calculation again, but I think the idea is that this factor would be corrected by a factor that's related to the AGN.
It must be a factor of 10 to the 3 or something. Right?
Yeah, but again, you know, it's not like we're hurting for factors.
Well, no, I think it gets it down to 1.
It gets it down to 1, but my point is that if this is getting replenished, then this factor would go up by a factor of, you know, however many the ratio of tau AGN to the age of the universe would be.
Well, but if you multiply the number of galactic nuclei times, if FAGN is the fraction of galactic nuclei that is AGN,
mm-hmm.
that takes into account for this replenishment thing, right? Because if there are multiple episodes, then your fraction of AGN is higher.
Right.
Yes, but the idea is that not all. So it depends on what. So you can do a calculation like this where this is only including for the fact of the things that are actively accreting right now at some efficiency, and then you have to define what constitutes actively accreting, which means some sort of cut on the X-ray luminosity function, right? Which, you know, which is annoying, right? I mean, you can, I have references back there which you can do cuts on the AGN luminosity function. This, or you can normalize to everything, assuming that they all have some accretion at some point in their life,
okay,
that this is getting repopulated, and that this is, then this factor is basically of order one, is the, but if you want to normalize this to make this NAGN, then you'll get a fraction of all the things that are merging through this process, because you wouldn't be accounting for the repopulation of these things,
but,
the multiple.
If that is a factor of order one, I assume that, suppose all the other Fs are order one, right? Mm-hmm. Then that means that every galactic nucleus accretes 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 black hole in 10 to the 7 years, which means you have like 10 to the 10 black holes accreting per apple time in every galactic nucleus.
Wait, so say that again?
So if I assume all the Fs equal to 1,
mm-hmm,
and yep, M black hole is 10 to the 4, right? That yep means that every galactic nucleus accretes 10 to the 4.
We already know that this is wrong for a number of reasons, right? Because LIGO rules this out already by a factor of 10, at least.
No, yeah, but you know, if you take the first line.
Yes.
Okay, the first line tells you that, you know, if all the Fs are equal to 1,
mm-hmm,
essentially you accrete M black hole in TGN, right? And that's per galactic nucleus.
You have N black holes
per
AGN put into the migration trap. Do all these get? You're worried about like the Emery rates or something like that, or?
No, I'm worried about
the overall population.
I yeah
mean, I said if N black hole is 10 to the 4 and then the AGN is 10 to the 7.
Yes.
That gives you that each galactic nucleus yeah creates a black hole every 1,000 years, which is
high.
Right, so that's 10 to the 7 over the age of the universe, right?
Which is, it doesn't violate a mass bound for...
Well, I mean, it violates the AGN black hole density bound.
It's by a lot. It's,
you're concerned about like the local cusp density for recoil velocity of the galactic center?
No, just the mass density in galactic nuclei black holes.
This you get from the mass density. I'm confused which complaint you. So all of the, so this argument, you can basically get the same argument. This is basically like Brian's argument, where you do the classical sulfide argument. The key thing that differs here is basically this factor, right? The rest of this is the classical sulfide argument.
Okay, but in the classical sulfide argument, the tau AGN does not enter.
Yes.
That's why I think there's a factor basically of yes age of the universe to tau AGN screwed up in this equation.
So there's a factor there, but the idea is that you're going to get repopulation.
That's irrelevant, because if it repopulates when it's an AGN, that comes into the FAGN. It should cancel out.
So I think in that equation, either you have the age of the universe at the bottom, or you have FAGN that is the number of some AGN that is like 10 to the minus 3 or something.
But we have the, I mean, that's...
We can...
Okay, maybe we should...
We should go
offline, because this is going to go on for a while. Okay, so as you can see, this is very controversial and has an enormous range. I think that is very fair to say. Now, can you compare it with observations? Well, yes. The rate, not so much, for reasons that we just went into. The mass distribution, what it will tend to predict is very high mass ratio binaries. It will also tend to predict binaries that have chi effective bounded away from zero. So one thing you can do is look at things that are high mass that LIGO has reported. So this is one. So there's no compelling evidence for a hierarchical scenario. This has been done in several papers. This paper, which is Yang et al., also found the same thing. But at least it's in the right ballpark. And so one might hope that in the future one might find other things more consistent with the later hierarchical generations. The other thing that one can do is look at the LIGO observations reported to date, which through the absence, this is a very, very messy corner plot, provide some constraint on the merger rate in the various components. Now, these constraints are not very good, and I apologize for the ridiculous font size, because LIGO is actually not that sensitive. So the upper limit is, let's see, 100 some per cubic gigaparsec per year. So a factor of 10 smaller than the upper limit that you had over there, or the order of magnitude presented in the previous slide. But that's mainly because LIGO is actually not incredibly sensitive to very high mass ratio mergers. If you're looking at mergers of 50 plus 1,000, your 1,000 solar mass black hole has a characteristic frequency which is, you know, prevents you from having frequency in the LIGO bucket. So if you take into account the fact that LIGO isn't sensitive to anything except the lower component, the lower mass component of the intermediate mass black hole spectrum, your ability to constrain things, unless this merger rate is very, very, very high, the only way that you're going to constrain things in the near future with this is if you have very highly spinning black holes with a very high merger rate. But, you know, that's possible. Now, if people have questions over exactly what went into this, I can go through that, but it sounds like the question that we have most is the normalization of the order of magnitude.
Well,
yes. How many others, actually?
Okay.
One of the other questions, do you expect in this scenario that the merger rate is going to be pretty much directly correlated with the instantaneous accretion rate of the AGM?
Most of these things are actually merging in the duration of the AGM disk. You obviously, when you stop accreting, they stick around. So there will be a 1 over T, you know, population decay. But, you know, in the simulations that we've done, we left the accretion on long enough that most of these mergers are occurring during the active phase.
I'm actually thinking about the actual accretion, like grams per second. Mm-hmm. So if you have two AGN, one which is accreting at one solar mass per year, and one is accreting at a tenth of solar mass per year.
Yeah.
You expect the first one to have 10 times the rate of the second. And I ask this in part because of something Searle brought up last week, which is that if this scenario suggests that if the luminosity of the AGN is what's basically giving you that's proportional to the rate in which you should be having these mergers, then in the local universe, you may be able to look for the brightest AGN. I mean, what's the story in terms of the actual total luminosity of the AGN within Z of a half? Are they dominated by a relatively small number of objects?
Yeah, I mean, the integrated contribution to the background light is dominated by the quasars, not the Seyferts and Liners. So if the mass and the disk is sort of proportional to the M dot getting onto the black hole, then it's dominated by the quasars rather than
But then the higher luminosity comes from the more massive black holes, right?
Yes.
But the more massive black hole will not have nuclear clusters, so all the estimates of the black holes around there should be much, much smaller. This should be dominated by the low mass massive black holes anyway, irrespective of the AGN. So I should actually have, at about 10 to the 8, you stop having nuclear clusters. So above that,
But then those will have quite low disk masses, probably, right? So I think, I mean, it's important not to mix up, right? If it's dominated by the pathetic little liners, there's not very much gas going through. Then you may have a lot of black holes. If it's dominated by the bright ones, I agree. The story is that they merged and gotten rid of their stellar cusps. But I don't quite see why, if you have a dense accretion disk like in a quasar, the star formation in the outer parts of the disk should be much more spectacular, right? So the old static cusp would have been destroyed, but if you're actually making the things out of the disk, which seems reasonable, right? But
yeah, but
it's also then you don't have capture from the
gas,
which is what they usually assume in some sense. Yeah. The other thing, you have mostly the star formation in the outer parts, and then it's not very clear that it could actually even migrate inside. You cannot diffuse too much because the excitation time is too long.
But the disk is self-gravitating. I mean, if you sort of follow from the inside out, the disk becomes self-gravitating at about 1,000 gravitational radii, which I think is plenty close for this.
So if you get star formation in the AGN disk, it's extremely effective, and yes, maybe else.
So that's Brian's paper.
The thing is that Brian? If it's too effective, then you don't have the disk.
That's Brian.
Right, yeah, this is Brian's paper.
It's so famous problem.
You kill yourself, right, yeah. If it's too effective. Yeah. What I'm saying is, I think it will only work for short times on the lower mass message level calls. So the kind of host that you have would be these kind of...
Yeah, and one of the things that we haven't done that we need to do more carefully, but we haven't for a lot of the reasons that have been discussed, is do a careful population average where we calculate the relative contribution of different source regions, accounting for the fact that some of them are not going to be very efficient producers of these sorts of disks. Now, but the problem with, well, it's not a problem. I mean, you can get 30 mergers per cubic gigaparsec per year from star formation in the disk, and I mean, that's Brian's paper, right? Assuming you believe, as we just talked about, that you can get fragmentation, everything is going to work right. As Hagai was saying, you know, the thing that we really want to do is have more segregation and boost the merger rate by accounting for the cusp nearby, assuming that you have a cusp that lasts long enough.
And then that again happened on the other.
But you know, we have an average over the whole population. This is, you know, we're still at the spherical cow, Milky Way equivalent galaxy sort of thing. We're not doing a cosmological time average, properly accounting for the luminosity function of different galaxies.
Fair enough. It's the early stages. And I reviewed one of these papers. The scaling, that was a problem for me, because these things don't scale very well, just because of these kind of issues.
Yeah, and so it does scale, but you know, if you put some reasonable cutoffs in a reasonable amount of space, you know, there's enough room here, and here, I mean, if you have a cusp, that it wouldn't surprise me if there's a reasonable contribution, because this is, you know, this is ridiculously large. So as long as you have some reasonable fraction, and we can resolve the lifetime argument, then I think there's a reasonable prospect. Yes.
Can I ask a question about something very different?
Yep.
Yeah, sure.
If you go back to the spin distribution, you haven't talked about precession.
No.
Are they going to be relatively different? Is the high chi effective also about high in plane spin?
So we were talking about this earlier. These are mostly going to be aligned. There is something that we realized about the
bulk.
The bulk are going to be random, so they'll be probably weakly precessing. The trap are probably mostly aligned if chi effective is positive. If chi effective is negative, there's a certain subpopulation which have a certain instability which will make them precessing in band, but that's really obscure. So loosely speaking, the trap are mostly aligned, and the bulk are mostly isotropic-ish. So, I mean, there would be distinctive signatures for the different populations for what you would expect for spin alignment. But this, you know, assumes our, you know, alignment process that Cole was skeptical about. And, you know, if you have weaker alignment processes, then you could well end up with randomly aligned spins. Although for a hierarchical merger, I would personally be very surprised if you could have arbitrary population of orbits around the intermediate mass black hole. Relative to the disk. So I would assume that you'd have a preferential alignment, but you know, I can understand that people might be skeptical of the alignment process.
Preferential alignment with the disk?
Yes.
So everything is just...
Yeah, so they're all, these things are the ideas that they're going to track with either with or against the disk sense of rotation. Other things? More tomatoes? Fresh fruit? Okay.